Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we are talking about defence and about homes. Firstly, the Integrated Review, officially titled Global Britain in a Competitive Age. It's an enormous review of Britain's defence and security over the rest of this century, how Britain is going to be fit for purpose, particularly with reference to its armed forces. It's just been published, and I'm going to be speaking to Jane McKenzie and Solomon Hughes about which bits of the armed services have been treated well in it and which bits might not have been in terms of kit, capability and recruitment. I'm also going to be talking to Heather Mills about park homes. These are beautiful, leafy bits of the country, perfectly ready for retirement. They're also open to sharp practice by various unscrupulous site owners who have been getting into the magazine recently for their bad behaviour. But first, defence. At the launch of the Conservative Manifesto, all the way back in November 2019, unimaginably distant now, Boris Johnson said to his listeners, "We will not be cutting our armed services in any form. We will be maintaining the size of our armed services." That has turned out not to be exactly true. A newly published report, the Integrated Review of Britain's Security and Defence Capabilities, has just been published, and there have been lots of headlines about Britain raising the theoretical maximum number of its nuclear weapons, but there is plenty of other stuff in the review that has serious implications for the state of Britain's armed forces and security over the rest of this century. I spoke to Jane McKenzie and Solomon Hughes, both of the Eye, who have written about this in the current issue of the magazine. I started off by asking Jane to take us through some of the key points. First of all, recruitment and the actual strength of the army.
The new Defence Integrated Review proposes cutting the army down to a strength of 72,500, which is a theoretical cut of nearly 10,000 from the 82,000 and some.
Yeah.
Supposed number of personnel in the army at the moment. That's the target that the army should be recruiting to have. That's what it's sort of planned and budgeted to have.
Yeah. So at the moment we're aiming for 82,000.
82,000.
And so that cut down to 72.5. That's huge. That's more than a tenth.
What somewhat reduces how the impact of this will feel to the army is that because it's had such a poor recruitment situation for many years now since it started its deal with Capita, it is in fact only really 76,000 and some at the moment. So
clever. So by failing to fill its actual strength in the times when it was aiming for 82,000... they now don't have to sack as many people to get down to 72,000. Feels like a pretty Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah, and obviously it's a more complicated situation than that because you can't just stop having people coming in at the bottom end and feel like that's your cuts achieved because that's not how an army works in terms of throughput of people training and kind of coming through with more experience. And also, it's not just people, it's the skills those people have. And so Capita has particularly failed to recruit in some of the more highly skilled areas,
right,
where you would hope to bring people in with mechanic skills and things like that, rather than train everybody from a complete standstill.
Okay, and the Capita deal's been going for some time now, hasn't it? I mean, it's not a recent initiative.
It's not. It was a decade-long contract, which is something we've been reporting on for a good 6 years, I think, going awry. So
I think it's 2012 that the initial deal was signed.
The initial deal. Yeah. And then it fairly quickly became apparent that both, well, the MOD, the Army and Capita had all sort of misestimated and not understood the complexity of Army recruitment. And Capita had thought it could use sort of its typical recruitment software and discovered it had to build a whole new system to deal with the way the army is set up. So,
okay. Well, the good news is that it hasn't prevented the deal from being extended between Capita and the MOD. It's been extended for 2 years, and that will start in March 22, when the initial 10-year deal ends. So it's going to be at least 12 years that Capita's been in charge of recruitment now. And this issue of the magazine covers the process, doesn't it, by which you join. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
That's right. we were contacted by someone who is currently trapped in that process, who had hoped to be in the army by now, had started the process back before the pandemic hit, and is still in there. And he's been able to tell us some of the things that have kind of been hiccups along the way, and sense of just how why it moves like treacle when you're in there trying to join the army, and why so many people don't make it all the way through, because, well, that it's quite, if it takes a year or more to get in and to get to your first training date, strong possibility you'll find another job, come up with a whole other life plan within that time. So
yeah, the target is 6 months, isn't it? And they say it's going to be around 6 months, and then it's actually more like around a year, and often a bit longer than a year before you actually make it in.
Yes, very. For a brief period in 2019, it did look like it was improving. They might possibly get to the 6 months target, but I believe the pandemic then slowed all of that back down again. So
okay, and we should say it's not to do with incredibly rigorous entry requirements, which mean that, you know, it's only the toughest and the best who are actually making it in. It's just due to paperwork being incredibly slow, pinballing back and forth between different agencies, yes. This kind of thing.
Well, not only different agencies, but because Capita has its finger in so many pies, one of the extraordinary things this chap found was that he had to apply for his medical records from a company that provides medical records support to the NHS, which is run by Capita. It took him 8 weeks to get those records out of them. Then he had to send them to another branch of Capita, which deals with army recruitment, and it took them 4 weeks to get back to him to say that they'd received them. And so, you know, already that's 3 months of your recruitment time just spent shuffling some medical records paperwork from one part of Capita to another.
Wow. And that was an urgent case, I believe. That was something that was treated as an important, you know, get this out to this guy pronto case.
Well, certainly his GP mark this as urgent request, please, right, because, you know, it affects somebody's life plans. Yeah. This isn't just I'd like to have my medical records to frame them, or it was, please, this is related to a job. Could you expedite sending the records?
Yeah.
And that's just one stage of the process of getting approved to start training.
Solomon, I saw you nodding away there when we were talking about the incredible delays that Capita has. And you write about Capita in lots of other areas too, in terms of the services that have been outsourced. Is this typical?
It's them being more typical than they usually are. Because I think, you know, they're selling outsourcing as a kind of generic package, and that often falls down where the job isn't generic. You know, we can do anything, where the master of everything, they really end up being the master of none. And I think in army recruitment that is, you know, perhaps particularly pointed, because it is a particularly human thing, a particularly traditional thing. Army recruitment appeals to people with, you know, in certain traditional ways, which Capita weren't very good at doing. Of course, they did also do the revolving door thing, which is the classic thing of they're not very good at hiring soldiers hiring people from the forces except for at the very top. So before they won the very, very long-running recruitment contract they haven't been very good at, they did recruit a very senior vice admiral. He doesn't work for the Capita anymore, so perhaps maybe I won't name him particularly, but they recruited a vice admiral who had been involved in defence MOD contracting. He wasn't just doing sailing around in big ships. I might be giving some that might not be a fair picture of what vice admirals do, but he was involved in defence contracting, and then he got a job with Capita, and then Capita failed to recruit any more soldiers but him.
Right.
or seamen or airmen.
But in terms of all the equipment, it seems that there now are going to be cuts, vehicles not being upgraded, this kind of thing. So one of the things I think you were writing about, Jane, was the Warrior vehicle, and it's sort of maintenance program to keep it equipped and keep it capable.
That's right. The eye's been covering the problems with the Warrior upgrade project for quite some time, because the Warrior upgrade project's been going on for quite some time. Warriors and Challengers. So the Challengers are the tanks. The Warriors are fighting vehicles.
Okay.
Warrior tends to get called a mini tank in the tabloids. Technically, it is a fighting vehicle.
Yes.
One thing, back in 2009, I got into a lot of discussion with our readers about the nature of Warrior. And it's the thing is, we have a surprisingly large number, well, perhaps not surprising, but surprisingly a large number of readers, either in the military or with a military background, who are very aware of these differences. And if you blunder in, we understand something in terms of procurement, in terms of political committees investigating it, and we can spot the problems there, but then we blunder in and say it's the wrong thing, that can cause a great deal of difficulty. And so the Warrior looks like a tank because it's on tracks, and we think something on tracks with a turret is a tank, but a tank has to be heavily armoured enough to really get in there and fight a battle, whereas the Warrior's job is more to kind of be involved in a little bit of combat, but a lot of just driving soldiers around as a kind of a personnel carrier. So it has this kind of dual, slightly non-tanky role, even though it looks like a tank, and that's why it's a military fighting vehicle. But it is on tracks. And now I tried to get around this by saying it's a bit like an armoured car, because it's not as heavily armoured as a tank. And then people got very cross about that and said, no, armoured cars are only on wheels, that's on tracks, you're just out of order. So, you know, I beg our readers at this point to bear with us, because we have made important discoveries and exposures about purchasing, about how these systems work, and if we get the terminology wrong, please bear with us, correct us, but in a friendly manner.
Yes. Not all guns
please.
Blazing.
Yeah.
Or cannon. Okay. Or are they guns yeah. or are they cannons blazing, you see?
And they were both due to go through big upgrade packages, kind of recycle them for chassis, but put a new turret and guns okay. and sort of modern targeting equipment and things like that into them, which was going to then keep them going until 2040.
Seems sensible.
On the Warrior project, they had an £800 million budget for the upgrade. They have spent £227 million of that, and we haven't actually got an upgraded vehicle out of it. And now it's been cancelled.
So, to a casual reader, that's kind of mind-boggling, because it raises the question of what that money, those hundreds of millions of pounds, have been spent on. If we don't have a vehicle, or a contract for a vehicle, as you say.
No contract. There's been research and development and testing
okay.
and that kind of thing. It does cost
of
money.
Of course.
But it is not exactly well-spent money if it results in absolutely nothing at the end of the day for the army. So in terms of, you know, these recruits, what they're going to be in is not Warrior anymore. So we're just giving up on Warrior. It's had things like, it's had red lights from the Infrastructure Projects Authority. They've said this is really not likely to work. And there was a parliamentary committee report just last month which said that, you know, this project's gone extremely badly, completely deplorable. So they're not getting those, and the Challenger tanks, far fewer of those are going to get their upgrade as well. So in terms of our capability of sending people out in armoured vehicles, that's going to be much reduced.
One of the general issues is this, isn't it, is that where it comes to Ministry of Defence spending, they just really, really like these very expensive weapons systems. I mean, with a fighter plane, it's a weapon system because it's also the munitions that go on it, the whatever it can take off of, the boat it can or can't take off of, the training to supply or not to supply the pilots and so on and so forth. So there's a real bias towards spending money on these very long long-term weapons systems, which don't always come to fruition. They can be late. They can cost a huge amount. And it's been a puzzle. It sort of underlies this thing of where the Conservatives have gone for this very patriotic sounding thing of lots of squaddies, which is something that an idea that appeals to patriotic and traditional voters, lots of people in uniform. And then when it comes to it, it's like, well, we're actually going to slash the numbers of people in uniform and instead buy this expensive and speculative kit. There's a real bias towards it. And it's a question that's occupied Private Eye for a long time. It's a question that occupied somebody probably wouldn't agree with generally, Dominic Cummings, for quite a long time before he was booted out. Whether he'd have done anything about it, I don't know, but it was a question that preoccupied him. And the elements behind it, I think, are one is a desire to play with the big boys, you know, that if you want to project power across the world, you need these expensive machines where we can show, look, we're in the same game as the Americans, and we're a rival for the Russians. So we've built jet fighters that are theoretically going to be involved in a dogfight with the Russians, which they never are, and if they were, it would be terrible, because that could be a kind of gateway to nuclear war. But so we build these very expensive things. So that's one, is the desire to project power, which is play with the big boys. You know, we don't want just a strong UK army. We want to be able to fly all over the world with our jets next to the American jets and frightening off the Russian jets. There's the empire building in within the defence community, and there's obviously also in hoc to the defence industry, the massive revolving door between senior defence officials and senior military officials into the defence industry. I saw the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments annual report came out recently, and they say in it the highest proportion of applications for people going from senior government or senior official positions into private industry comes from the Cabinet Office 1, the Ministry of Defence 2. They're the two. That's right. So that's another issue. And of course, also the defence industry is an export industry. So there's a tremendous confusion in Ministry of Defence. Are we supporting a big export industry to sell lots of the jets that we use to Middle Eastern nations or other people who are really horrible? Do we make money that way, and where the army and the air force and navy are just a kind of big advertisement for these people, or is it because we actually want them ourselves? And these confusion leads them to spend money on these expensive things. Now, in the defence review, there was sort of a kind of here's some good news, here's some bad news on that. And the good news was that we've been committed to buying the Lockheed's F-35 jet fighter. I think we've committed to more than 100 and something for a long time. And they, you know, really almost still, you know, they've been in development for years. And even though you can see them flying around, they're sort of still in development. There was an audit office report that we reported on in 2020 where they said the F-35 jet fighter, which principally made by Lockheed, BAE are involved, and some other companies are involved again. They said it became operational in 2018. 5 years late, it was meant to be 2013, but with many serious what they call exceptions. So it's operational, but there's still things it can't do. Okay. Now, so we've been writing about the F-35 being a bit, you know, all show, no action, you know, for a long time, you know, very flashy, but doesn't actually work, you know, for a long time, and potentially being one of these big wastes of money that happen. Now, in the defence review, they say, oh, well, you know, we're going to limit ourselves to buying the original 48 that we promised to buy, and that costs 10.4 billion. So if you want to buy one, you know, obviously you want to get saving now. They're expensive. So we're just going to go down to 48. And that's sort of good news. Oh, we're backing off for this, you know, this perhaps flying white elephant. But one of the reasons we're buying less is so we can buy more of the Tempest jet, the next generation jet. And Tempest is amazing. It's an airplane with a brain. It's going to be highly automated, and it's going to fly with its own drones around it. Some of them will be swarming drones, which I think means they do what they, you know, they act on algorithms, and then some will be controlled. So it's absolutely an incredible plane. We're going to spend the money. We're not going to waste it on the F-35, which is a bit dicky. We're going to spend it on the Tempest, which is amazing. Of course, the Tempest doesn't exist. It's just an idea. I saw the Tempest, I think it's Gavin Williamson. I saw it with Gavin Williamson as at the Farnborough Air Show. Farnborough Air Show is partly it's somewhere to go and show excitable boys and girls planes in the air, but also it's a massive arms fair. And so the BAE are leading Tempest, not the only firm, but the BAE pavilion had this Tempest jet in it, and you went and looked, and it just looked like science fiction. It looked amazing, and there's a big launch of Tempest by Team Tempest. But of course, if you went up and knocked on it, it's just a big plastic model, you know.
It's not even,
well, it really, and I mean, Airfix were like models of planes that actually flew, as this is just an Airfix model of a plane that doesn't exist yet. So we're committing to spending a lot of money on Team Tempest, and I think there's a big possibility that this will be another big flying elephant that will come in late. I think they said, did they say when it was supposed to come in?
I think 2035.
It's meant to come in 2035. So get ready for Team Tempest to be sort of crashing in 2040. So it's a big and if you've got similar problems, it's a BAE are leading it, and I think partly that's why, because the F-35 is Lockheed, and we're kind of, it means we have to do what the Americans do, and the Americans have been rude to Britain, haven't they? They've said you can buy these F-35s, but you can't have all of the computer codes, which is a bit like saying you can't have the full instruction manual, you know, in case you know too much, so you can fly it, but you can't understand it. So they've been a bit rude, whereas I guess they're hoping with Tempest it will be more British controlled. It's being done with Tempest is BAE, and I think the second possibly biggest company in the consortium is a company called Leonardo, who are Italian, and so, you know, it puzzled me for a bit, you know, when I was like, when I first saw it, I was like, I can't remember who are Leonardo, but they're not really Leonardo, well, they are Leonardo, but they changed their name. They used to be called Finmeccanica, which kind of means engineering company in Italian, more or less. I need now to continue working for at least the next 15 years to be able to report this story fully.
To write the I told you so piece.
Yeah. It's promised in 10, so, you know.
The Americans are also very generously lending us F-35s, aren't they, to put on the decks of the aircraft carriers that we are sending currently to the South Pacific, although we don't have enough F-35s to put there at the moment.
Yes, so we don't have to send an embarrassingly empty aircraft carrier towards China.
And given that we apparently don't have the full instruction manual anyway, that feels like a bit of a no-score draw on the F-35.
It's tremendous. I think in a way, you know, because I mean, that in a way, the sort of South China Seas is a thing where it's, you know, the Ministry of Defense wants to project power on an international scale. That's to say, it wants to play with the big boys and show that we can stand up to China or stand in the shadow of America, depending on which way you look at it. But I just think they should have sent it with a... We could have had all the aircraft carriers carrying Tempests, you know, because they're just... as they're, but just as long as we could have just somehow persuaded the Chinese that these are actually, you know, a secret weapon and capable of, you know, travelling through time, perhaps.
Solomon Hughes there. Thanks to him and Jane McKenzie. Another story that's been in the back pages of Private Eye a great deal over the last few months covers park homes. Park homes are static mobile homes. They are spread across the country. They are inexpensive. They are loved by retirees. And unfortunately, that model of home ownership can lead to difficulties. If you have a park home, you will also have a site owner, someone who owns the land on which your home is sitting. And this can lead to enormous difficulties and conflicts. Conflicts about which Heather Mills has been writing a great deal. She has detailed all the sharp practice by various park home owners. And when I spoke to her, my first question was about what exactly a park home is. Here's Heather.
They're dotted all over the country. They're quite often in very nice kind of leafy areas, and they are mobile homes, basically. They're static mobile homes, so they can be quite sizable. And they're very attractive for, you know, people who retire. It frees up income, you know, so they tend to be cheaper than bricks and mortar. They're in these lovely locations quite often. It means that older people don't necessarily have to worry about, you know, or supposedly don't have to worry about repairs and services and all of those things that come when you're trying to look after the upkeep of your house. Because although you own your park home, you don't own the site that it's on. So you pay a site fee for that. And that is quite often where the problems come in as well.
Okay.
So you own your home, but you don't own where it's placed, and you pay a site fee for, you know, the provision of water, electricity, upkeep of the land around you, all of that kind of stuff.
So one of the most obvious points of potential friction between a homeowner and a site owner is over the provision of these services, whether that's heating or water or electricity or whatever it might be. And you've written about the electricity thing a bit, particularly in reference to Wildcrest Parks, which is one of the large companies that owns lots of sites all over the UK.
Yeah, Wildcrest Parks is run by a guy called Alfie Best, who's, you know, a multi-millionaire, huge wealth. He refers to himself as the Gypsy King.
Okay.
And he was in the Sunday Times Rich List, but, you know, kind of boasting of his rags to riches story, which is all very credible. But, you know, he's notorious in the park home world for things like building or putting more caravans on sites without any planning permission, and then, you know, trying to get planning permission later, for inflated charges and fees for some of these sites. We wrote about him recently because he was trying to get extra written agreements put on sites, which potentially could undermine, you know, park home owners, i.e. the residents, could affect their statutory rights because they've signed another agreement. And most recently, he tried to set himself up as a social housing landlord as well.
Okay. And so the idea behind becoming a social landlord is that he would own a lot of sites and a lot of homes and then rent them out, is that right, as social housing?
Yes, I think that was the plan. He got into bed with a city investor called Concept Capital Group. And the aim was that investors would invest $40,000 a shot to buy these homes, site, you know, that Best would provide. Mm. And then they would be let out to social housing, for social housing. I mean, all sorts of problems with that, not least of all, was that, you know, he's not a registered social housing landlord.
And I imagine there are, you know, particular requirements of social housing landlords that they're fit and proper people.
You just can't set yourself up in that way.
Another thing we should say is that it's not just a case of Wildcrest Parks or Alfie Best, although they have been involved in lots of incidents of malpractice. It's not unique to them. This is a thing that happens again and again across the entire sector. So there are examples that you've written about of harassment or people being conned into buying homes that are much older than the owners say they are, the site owners say they are, misleading them about age, this kind of thing as well.
And in fact, the row is still going on. There was a guy down in Kent called Fred Sines, and Pilgrims Park, which is a very pretty park built in the Kent area of outstanding natural beauty. And he's had various run-ins with the local authority over developing parts of the site that he shouldn't have done, right, you know, in an AOMB, or again, you know, without permission, which seems to happen quite a lot, do it and then fight over it later. Yeah. And what happened on this park was that he had permission for 198 homes, but the bulk of them were holiday homes. Okay. But actually, he'd sold an awful lot of them as permanent residences. And he then went well beyond the 198 limit, I think maybe 50 homes more. And the council decided enough is enough and have decided to serve him with enforcement notices for these homes that didn't have permission. And of course, with that, you know, you've got people now who bought them in good faith, suddenly facing potentially losing their homes. Mm. Oh, and the other irony is that Maidstone Borough Council clearly hadn't appreciated for quite a long time that some of these were only holiday homes because they'd been charging these residents council tax as if they were permanent residents. So these poor people were caught both ways, if you like. That's still subject to sort of legal wrangling. They've tried to draw up a compromise deal whereby some of these people who bought homes that don't have planning permission and where they're trying to reinstate the countryside, they're trying to resite them within the grounds of the existing site.
Okay.
But I think the owner, Sines, is saying, I haven't got enough room to move them all. So there's still a bit of limbo there. Then there's this other horrendous guy called Christopher Neddick, who's been terrorising some guy, very old guy, Ron Joyce, who's lived on this park home for ages, long before Neddick took it over, had a glorious garden, but Christopher Neddick wanted to move his home, so he bulldozed the garden to try and drive him out. And then Mr. Neddick has recently won a tribunal against his site owner, and the site owner has now dumped a massive tip right outside his front window, so, you know, blocking his view and everything else. Gosh. And that, too, is going to go back to a tribunal.
It feels like it's all down to this slightly strange, uneven relationship where the site owner is not exactly a landlord and isn't quite a freeholder. Or is it just that the rules are in place?
Well, I suppose in a way they are the freeholder. They're the freeholder to the site, yeah. You know, and the park. You know, a bit like a block of flats in a sense. And, you know, you own your home, but you rent the site. But there are all sorts of clauses and these written agreements. And, you know, there've been some cases where some of the leaseholds had a limited time period on them. And again, older people maybe, you know, not reading all the small print everywhere, not spotting all these little things that can catch them out. And it shouldn't make it sound like all park homes around the country are bad, because they're not. And clearly, you know, many thousands of people live very nice lives on very nice estates.
I was about to say, we shouldn't imply that park homes are bad living. You will get lots of scrupulous site owners as well as unscrupulous ones. And
then, you know, all people's wishes to, you know, to have services provided, to live in a nice place, to, you know, have a little nest egg if they sell, to downsize, if you like, all of those things.
Yeah. But it sounds like the main point of advice you're giving is be very careful when you're signing up to one of these homes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely get your own lawyer. Lots of... again, to make everything easy, lots of park home owners quite often will provide legal services and everything else. Right. I think it's really important that people get independent advice. And one thing that quite often gets missed, and there's now there is going to be an investigation into this now, but this does apply to all park homes if they want to do it, is that when you sell your park home, if you want to sell your park home on site, 10% of the fee can go to, you know, or 10% of what you sell it for can go to the site owner.
Wow.
Which is an awful lot of money. Yeah. And park home owners have been trying to get rid of that 10% for a long, long time. And it's been through Parliament lots of times. It's never yet been changed. But it is now being looked at seriously, one would hope.
Heather Mills there. And obviously, Private Eye will be keeping pace with this story as it makes its way through the legislature and in case of any other bad practice by various site owners. Thanks to Heather again, and to our other contributors today, Solomon Hughes and Jane McKenzie. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We will be back again in a month. This is the longest we've ever kept up a streak of regular episodes, so don't get used to it. But we will be back again in a month with more stories from the magazine. The magazine, as always, is available to buy if you go to private-i.co.uk. Subscriptions are available. They're there. They're reasonably priced. Who knows, by the time the next episode is recorded, there may even be newsstands open for you to buy the magazine in again. But why take the risk? Why not subscribe now? Thank you for listening, and as always, thanks to our producer, Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. See you in a month. Goodbye.